Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 31 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed, that's for sure. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You could go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Be sure to visit his website at Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. I'll spell you his last name. It's C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Also, Ronnie's a two-time Fulbright Scholar recipient representing the United States in Bangladesh and Indonesia in the last 10 years. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which is also my hometown, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year we'll be publishing a book, Movers and Mavericks, an anthology of influential people from the Thunder Bay area, and early next year a book about the famous Ganalda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossbourne, Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is coming out. Actually, it came out today, and it's going to be available in local chapters, bookstores tomorrow, and various other locales. So hopefully we get a good run on that book. Well, tonight, Ronnie, we have as our very special featured guest, Anthony Amore, co-author with Tom Mashberg of the best-selling book titled Stealing Rembrandt's The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. His co-author, Tom Mashberg, is an investigative reporter who reported for the New York Times and Boston Globe for over 30 years. Anthony Amore is the head of security at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and is a contributing writer to the Boston Herald and the Huffington Post. On the same subject of art theft, Crime Beat is privileged to also have Eric Rasmussen, author of the book The Shakespeare Thefts, In Search of the First Folios. Rasmussen is a preeminent Shakespearean scholar and collaborator on more than 60 books about Shakespeare and Renaissance drama. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, I just before we reach into our mailbag this week, I'd just like to say, you know, we're cracking 100,000 listeners every week, and it's growing. You know, there's no turning back the clock now, man. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and a couple not so positive, but, you know, Ronnie, yeah, we'll take the good with the bad, buddy.
Hey, as your mother once said, nobody's perfect, right?
You're right. Anyway,
and don't forget all the listeners that can listen to the show, because all the shows are archived. So,
absolutely, 24/7 listening.
If you love our voices, they can listen to it forever.
Right on. Well, anyway, I'd like to thank our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making this show possible. Like I said many times before, Ronnie Boy, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Now, here's this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one is from Benjamin Runkle, who was our featured guest 2 weeks ago. We discussed his best-selling book titled Wanted, Dead or Alive, Manhunts from Geronimo to Bin Laden. We ran out of time during the show, but I wanted to have his views on whether, you know, that the decision not to publish photos of his corpse left a credibility gap about his demise. So I emailed him that question, and he was kind enough to write back. He says, he writes, I think that the decision not to release the photos of Bin Laden's corpse was wise from a strategic standpoint. Conspiracy theories will emerge regardless. I think the value of not offending Islamic sensitivities, as happened to a slight degree with the killing and display of Saddam Hussein's sons in July 2003, outweighs whatever temporary strategic communications gain could be made from displaying or photographing Bin Laden's body. Ben goes on to write, thank you again for having us on your show. It was one of the more enjoyable interviews I've done so far. Well, thanks for that, Ben. Anything to add to that, Ronnie?
Yeah, I think that the key is that their prevention of the creation of a martyr and the fact that they didn't publish the photos destroy his symbolic value to a larger movement. And, you know, if you look at what happened after Al-Qaeda's death, it's been very quiet, right?
Yeah.
So there hasn't been that much controversy about those pictures. At first there was, and then all of a sudden it disappeared. So it looks like it was the right decision.
Yeah.
And we move on, and Bin Laden's gone.
Absolutely, and good riddance to Bin Laden.
Right.
Well, Ronnie Boyd, you want to give our listeners out there in the wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, and tell us what you've been up to in your neck of the woods.
Right. Well, next week we go from Shakespeare and Rembrandt to Louis Ferrante, who's a former gangster and a guy that changed his life in prison. He claims he read everything in the English language while he was in prison, and he wrote a book about that. And he also wrote a book called Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman. And I'm halfway through the book, and it's really a fascinating book about some of the lessons. So even if you have a small business out there, tune in. I think you'll gain something from this conversation. I know it's going to be really lively.
Absolutely. I read the book, and I'm learning as I go. I operate a small business, too, so I've learned quite a bit.
Right.
Anyway.
So you're an operator like Lucky Luciano, right?
You bet your bananas. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, December 9th, 2011. San Francisco, California. Prosecutors want prison time for Barry Bonds. Hey, Ronnie, federal prosecutors want baseball legend Barry Bonds to serve 15 months in a slammer for his obstruction of justice conviction. According to a sentencing memo filed last Thursday, the disgraced former superstar slugger is set to be sentenced tomorrow. That's Friday, December the 16th, in San Francisco courtroom, less than 2 miles from the ballpark where he broke Hank Aaron's home run record. Hey, Ronnie, you know what? A lot of people are after this guy's neck. What do you?
Well, I mean, the timing couldn't be worse because baseball thought they put behind the steroid scandal, and Ryan Braun, who's a little darling, Milwaukee Brewers a player that won the most valuable player award, tested pulse positive. So I don't think that looks good for Bonds because let's face it, I think he should go to jail. I mean, you know, if you continue to give these guys a slap on the wrist, they're not going to change their behavior. And if you give them community service, he'll go home and hang out in the house. But if you put him in jail for a couple of years, it'll serve as a warning and a message to other baseball players that the steroid era is definitely over.
Well, yeah, you've got, I think you're right on that account. But I'll tell you, Ronnie, even though he broke the law, I think this is only a tempest in the teacup. Baseball fans will continue to go to the ballpark in record numbers, man. Even if it puts Major League Baseball under the microscope, you're going to have record crowds next year. You know, performance-enhancing drugs is here to stay, man.
Right. Well, the average American many times votes against their economic interests, as we're seeing in this presidential run. So it's not surprising that they'll continue to go and see baseball games, even though it's a corrupt sport.
Well, anyway, we'll keep an eye on this story. Tomorrow's going to be the big day for Barry Bonds. Let's see what happens. Now, let's get on to rap sheet item number two. Dateline, December the 11th. Panama City, Panama. Manuel Noriega returns to Panama to serve 20 years in jail. Hey, Ronnie, Manuel Noriega, the drug-running former Panamanian dictator, has been returned home from France to serve 20 years in jail for the murder of political opponents during his bloody rule in the 1980s. Noriega, who who's already spent more than two decades in U.S. and French prisons, may also face further trials in his home country for the deaths and disappearance of rivals. Hirani Noriega is bouncing from country to country. They should be, should name a pinball game after this.
Right. It always makes you want to feel sorry for old Pineapple Face. I was in Panama. I covered Noriega and the Panamanian Defense Force in the late 80s before the United States invaded on that. But he's serving three more sentences, so he'll never get out of prison. But his legal team is trying to get him to spend his time under house arrest. They got a law in Panama where if you're over 70, you can serve your time at home. And medically, he's a mess. He's got high blood pressure, peptic ulcers, and an allergy. And the medical authorities say he can move around. But I think we're going to see our last of Noriega.
Well, he's 77 years old, and any lengthy sentences, I think that he's going to meet his maker in the slammer. That's what I think. Anyway, Ronnie, just before we get on to our very, very special guest, we're going to take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have any questions for our guests, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, tonight's very, very special guests are Anthony Amore and Tom Mashberg, co-authors of the best-selling book titled Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. Anthony Amore teamed up with Tom Mashberg to write this fascinating book. Amore will discuss some of the most daring art heists ever. On the same subject of art theft, in our second half of the show, we have Mr. Eric Rasmussen, author of The Shakespeare Thefts, In Search of the First Folios. He'll talk about that fascinating, intriguing hunt for the most sought-after book in the world. Now, our first guest, Anthony Amore and Tom Mashberg, it's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Anthony and Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks great. For having us.
Well, this is a real treat. I've been to the Rembrandt House in Amsterdam at least three times, and I've seen the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I've seen some self-portraits in the Louvre. So this is a real treat, and especially two guys that have been called the Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson of the art world. How did you get that incredible? I can see that putting that on your book, right?
it fits nicely on the book. Tom and I both have spent an enormous amount of time looking into the theft of 13 priceless pieces of art from the Gardner Museum in Boston. Unfortunately, unlike Holmes and Watson, we haven't found what we're looking for, but we hope to.
Right. Well, you're a nice team. Anthony, you're the art expert, right?
I think I'm more of an art loss expert, unfortunately, but I do know.
Art loss expert, and Tom is the investigative journalist. So tell us how this book came about, Anthony.
Well, I joined the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum back in 2005 after having worked for Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, and those type of jobs. So I had to become acquainted with how art theft occurs because I was working at the Gardner where the largest art theft in history ever occurred. In 1990, we lost over $500 million worth of art. So I started researching all the art theft I could get my hands on and saw that it was really an enormous problem. Focused in on Rembrandts, we lost three Rembrandts at the Gardner, and looked at all of the Rembrandt thefts for the last 100 years and saw that they were all interesting stories. Every one of them seemed to be more of like a Coen Brothers film than a Ian Fleming novel. So I felt that they would make a good book, and I was friends with Tom, and Tom is an incredibly talented and well-respected journalist and an unbelievable way with words, so we were able to team up and put out what I think is a good book.
Right. Well, I understand from my research for this program that there's something like 2,000 Rembrandts that he painted, and something like 80 of them have been stolen at one time or another?
Well, 2,000 is what they once thought existed. At the turn of the century, there were so many paintings that were attributed to Rembrandt for many different reasons that The world thought there were that many paintings, and later part of the century, a thing called the Rembrandt Research Project formed to examine just what are actually Rembrandts. There are far less than 2,000 paintings, but there still are a heck of a lot of pieces.
Right. Why is Rembrandt, obviously he's a great artist, but, you know, Picasso was supposedly the most stolen artist of all time. But why is Rembrandt, why do they take Rembrandt? Is there something about the paintings that make them easy to steal?
Well, the obvious reason they take Rembrandt is because they've heard of Rembrandt. It's so famous that even your sort of least educated criminal knows that's got to be worth something. And, of course, your other point is right, too, which is that, unfortunately, a lot of art is easier to steal than you might think or might realize. And it certainly was in years gone by, perhaps less so now, although we still see the kinds of smash-and-grab type thefts. They're essentially armed invasions. You know, you rush in, you have weapons, and you intimidate everyone, you grab it off the wall, and you run out. And if you can do it quickly enough, you'd be surprised how many criminals could pull that off.
Right. Well, that's interesting because, you know, I had until, I read your book, that the artist, the art thief was someone like Thomas Crown, very interested in art and very, very intelligent. But most of the criminals aren't like that, right?
You're not alone.
I mean, average art thief is really a ill-educated, almost like a neighborhood or community criminal, somebody who's graduated from, breaking and entering to maybe robbing a 7-Eleven or some sort of gas station, and who gets the big idea that because he hears somewhere that there's a Rembrandt in there and, wow, that's worth $10 million,
right.
If he breaks it and steals it, he can quickly turn it into $10 million on the street. And, of course, the very first thing these guys realize is that they've taken a hostage. They haven't stolen something that they can turn into cash.
Right. It's one thing to steal a Rembrandt, but you know, if you don't really know the art market or have your network, how do you unload it as a thief?
Even if you know the art world or have a network, you still can't unload it. Now, when Tom and I speak about these things, we're referring to masterpieces. And if you steal something that's highly visible or well known, it's impossible to fence. We found in this research in the book show, there are really no instances in which people have stolen Rembrandts and made any money on it. And the popular belief is the one you expressed, and I think that's what most people would say. They think it's... paintings are in the hands of a billionaire somewhere who's bought it, but it doesn't work that way in the real world. They wind up under people's beds and in their attic.
Right, because as you point out in your book, that a lot of these people are stealing it for art, right? They're not stealing it for appreciation of art. They're not stealing it because they want to make money out of it. You know, they want to own a Rembrandt, and they want to sit in their living room at night and smoke a cigar, drink a brandy, and look at this painting.
No, it's the exact opposite. It's they don't steal it because they want to look at it or because they love art. They steal it because it's strictly because they want to make money.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, they're never successful. I think, Tom, you'd agree with that.
Right.
Oh, yeah, you were talking about the big myth of the kind of evil character, maybe like Dr.
Right.
No from James Bond, who has the art stolen by some criminals with great expertise and... You know, he pays them a lot, and then he enjoys it all privately, like you said, while sipping his cognac. But that's actually one of the biggest myths of all. We haven't been able to find a single example of a character like that behind any art theft, let alone a Rembrandt theft. And that's really just that's a Hollywood myth. It's very entertaining, and we all kind of enjoy it. And it feels a little bad, frankly, to puncture it because, people do like that. Like that image, but it's really not the case with this kind of art theft.
Right. Can you give us some examples of some of the thieves that you think are pretty typical, profile of somebody that wants to steal, art objects? I know you have a story about Florian L. Mundy, and you mentioned Miles Connor. You know, some of these characters in your really interesting characters in your book. Can you talk about that, some of the typical art thieves?
We can, and it's interesting because Tom knows Miles Connor really well, and I know Al Mundy really well, and I think Tom would agree with this, that they're in the book because their stories are so interesting. However, in a different way, they're kind of atypical of art thieves. Miles, and I'll let Tom expand this, but Miles is atypical because he's one of the few people who's stolen a masterpiece more than once. Usually it's your one time and you see the folly of your endeavor. And Al Mundy is different because Al really understands art, and he really is an art lover, but make no mistake, when he committed his thefts, he did them strictly for monetary gain. You agree with that,
right,
Tom?
Right.
Absolutely. You're right. Even somebody, even a character like Connor or Mundy, who do have some appreciation for art and can tell the difference between, say, a Rembrandt and a Van Gogh, are stealing it for the money they can, or for, you know, some sort of use they can make out of it, other than just looking at it on their wall.
Right. Well, I mean these guys are violent, right? I mean, there was guns involved with their thievery.
Well, right. Absolutely. I mean, in the case of Al Mundy, he is the originator of the use of a firearm to rob a museum. Before his time, the thieves had commonly just broken in, mostly during the night. And in his case, he sent in a couple of goons, and they had a .22 revolver with one bullet in it, which they were not supposed to use. It was just to be waved around. And they grabbed the art off the walls, and as they were making their way out of the building, this, skinny old security guard, sort of tries to intervene and jumps on top of these guys, and the next thing you know, he's shot in the hip. And there was blood on the floor in that instance.
Right. So what did he get for his crime?
Al served, he was given a pretty long sentence. I think is for the period, this is 1972, and art theft didn't have the big numbers associated with it in terms of sentences. But I think, if I remember correctly, he got 9 years, but he only served a very short portion for, interesting chain of events that happened in the legal system. So he didn't pull the trigger. So Al wasn't the shooter. He was involved in the conspiracy. A lot of people ratted on each other to get lower sentences, and just an incredible. That story is one of my favorite because it's such an incredible turn of events with that painting wound up at a pig farm in Rhode Island. And it's just, for the people who believe these things wind up in somebody's den, some millionaire's den, and in fact it was at a pig farm, I think that's a good illustration.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, well, Ronnie, Miles, Excuse me,
before you go, this Miles Connor was supposed to be a member of a Mensa, the Mensa Society, that high IQ group. That
yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess he qualified. You're right. You take an IQ test, and if your number's above a certain point, you qualify for Mensa.
Right. Well, he wasn't too smart because I understand one of his accomplices raked the museum steps with machine gun fire to hold off the guards.
Yes, that's true. I mean, the thing about Connor's thefts is that even when they involved elaborate, use of getaway vehicles and armed men. He made sure that nobody was ever injured. At the time that he was thieving, these were not federal crimes, the theft of art of this kind. And he had so many connections in the justice system that he could sort of get some amount of leniency as long as he didn't harm, somebody, as long as it wasn't a bloody crime. So that was kind of one of his interesting skills, actually, was to sure not to harm people.
That's interesting. Willie, when you want to ask a question, then I'll ask
one. You bet. Okay, I've got one for Anthony or Tom. You know, fellas, can you give our listeners out there an idea of how many Rembrandts are stolen and unrecovered to this date, and what's the value of these art pieces?
Well, the book, one of the things that Tom and I were proud of is that the book gives a list for the first time how many Rembrandt thefts there were in the last 100 years, and we enumerate 81. And, of course, a month after the book was published, an 82nd theft happened in Marina del Rey, California. A great many of them are recovered. there, the two most significant thefts that haven't been solved are the Gardner Museum, of course, where the Rembrandts alone, just the three Rembrandts alone, are worth probably in the field of $250 million.
Wow.
And there was a theft in the early 70s from the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts, in which a Rembrandt was among 19 pieces that was stolen. And that's never been recovered either. And then there's also an instance where one Rembrandt that was stolen in the late 1930s was burned, so that wasn't recovered. There are a number of others that haven't been, but the major pieces that have been stolen, save for the Gardner Museum, have been basically been recovered.
Right. We were talking about Miles Connor, and we're talking about Al Mundy and the guns. Has anybody been killed in the course of trying to steal a Rembrandt?
I've not seen an instance where a person was killed in the commission of the crime, but there are plenty of instances where people are rumored to have been killed as a result of the crime. In other words, for to keep people quiet or to get the painting from one person to another.
Right. These heists don't seem particularly bright. Was there any heist that you thought was particularly innovative and ingenious?
Well, most of these heists really are old-fashioned home invasions, just sort of on a larger scale. Actually, the one they call the Skylight Caper out of Montreal is a fairly interesting crime, mm-hmm. because of the way they accessed the museum and what they took and how they got out. But one strong indication that the thieves were not, art lovers of any kind was the devastation they left behind in that museum, as you... Mm-hmm. guys may know, they smashed frames and showcases, and they just sort of, devastated large areas to find the items they wanted. So, these crimes are mostly, I guess the best word to describe them is farcical, because, the thieves, they break in, and in one case in Ohio, the thieves took the wrong Rembrandt. They took a Rembrandt that was far less valuable than the one they had set about trying to steal. And then you do have one in Stockholm in 2000 where it was a very well-designed armed blitz into the museum, and they very cleverly got in and out, and they raced off onto a skiff with a motor, and they motored off into the canals around Stockholm, cleverly escaping, except that they had left a huge clue behind, which was that the guy they bought their getaway skiff from, they gave him their cell phone number when they went to buy it. So when the cops track down the owner, he hands them the receipt, and there's the cell phone number of one of the criminals on it. So you get the sense that they're not always thinking this through.
Right. Well, we were just getting started here, but we're closing down the interview, unfortunately, but we may have a guy out there who's drinking a brandy and admiring some painting. What advice would you give to people that want to protect their art? We got about 30 seconds.
For people who want to protect the art, the first thing I would do is be cautious about who you have into your home in terms of contractors and workers, babysitters, that type of thing, because often... half of all art crime in the United States happens out of homes, and it usually involves a contracted worker.
Wow, that's good there. And we are with Anthony Amore and Tom Ashberg, the authors of Stealing Rembrandt, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heist. There's a website where you can go to get more information, www.stealingrembrandts.com. And gentlemen, do you have any tips for buying your book? I guess it must be in all the bookstores, right? Amazon.com, etc.
Yes, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, Powell's.com, and it's in every brick-and-mortar bookstore you can imagine.
Right.
But you could go to our site and link to any of those sellers.
Right. Well, we recommend it. It's a great read, and we wish you continued success with your book. And thank you so much for being on the program with us, gentlemen.
Thank you, fellas.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks, gents.
Okay, and Willie.
Yeah, you bet, Ronnie. Wow, we need more time with those fellows.
Right.
We'll have
we'll
them
invite
back for sure. Now, a special thanks to Anthony Amore and Tom Ashberg, co-authors of Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. The publisher of the book is Paul Grave Macmillan. You know, Ronnie, I just finished reading the book today. It's a page-turner, that's for sure. I recommend it highly to all of you out there. And it's a great book. It's worth every penny. Now, at this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Now, at this time, we are pleased to introduce Mr. Eric Rasmussen, author of The Shake Thefts in Search of First Folios. First Folios was published in 1623, and it was the first edition of William Shakespeare's collected works. In his wonderful book, Rasmussen offers a rare glimpse between the covers of one of the most coveted books in the world. It's going to be another great interview, so stick around. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Professor Eric Rasmussen.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Great. Really enjoyed your book. I mean, we didn't realize Shakespeare could be so much fun. to be or not to be, the famous soliloquy, I had to memorize it, and I still can quote it verbatim. And we had grade 13 in Thunder Bay, and I didn't really appreciate Shakespeare until I went to college and I took a Shakespeare appreciation course. And I'm wondering, Professor, if you could tell us how you got interested in Shakespeare. Did you have to memorize to be or not to be when you were
in high school? I think making students memorize Shakespeare is a way to alienate all of them. It was interesting. When I was very young, when I was 3 years old, my parents bought a Pontiac Tempest. Remember the old Pontiac Tempest?
Yeah,
right.
My mother named it Miranda after the character in Shakespeare's Tempest.
Right.
And so I was sort of locked in from then as a sort of a life in Shakespeare.
On that, and you went to college, got your PhD in Shakespeare, and then in 1996, you developed this really interesting project, right, to document Shakespeare's first folios. Tell us how that got started, and first explain what a first folio is for our listeners.
About half of Shakespeare's plays were published during his lifetime in sort of cheap paperback quarto editions, and then 7 years after his death, two of Shakespeare's fellow actors decided to bring out his collected works, all 36 plays, half of which hadn't been published before. And they decided to do it in a grand folio edition. It's a huge book. This is 15 inches tall by 9 inches
right.
wide by 3 inches thick. It's a really... And before this time, folios had only been used for works of philosophy and theology and history and for
right.
Bibles. And so it was a real risk, and it took 2 years to produce. It was an enormously expensive venture, and it cost a pound when it came out. And a pound in this time was about what a skilled laborer could expect to earn in 3 months. So a hugely expensive book. And they started. They were stolen almost from the time they were first printed, and have been throughout the centuries. And they've also been coveted by the very rich. And in the 20th century, people like Henry Huntington, the railroad magnate, bought 4 copies. And then, not to be outdone, Henry Clay Folger, who was Rockefeller's partner in Standard Oil, bought 82 copies. So a third of the copies that are known in the world now are in the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington.
Right. I understand Paul Getty paid $7 million for a folio, so that's a staggering amount of money, right?
And then died very shortly thereafter. And indeed, Paul Allen, who was Bill Gates' partner as a co-founder of Microsoft, paid $6.1 million for his recently.
Yeah.
They gave it to his sister, which I think is a nice, nice little Christmas gift.
Right. Well, that's interesting, because you do point out that many folio owners died within a few years, right, or even a few months of acquiring their copy.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Is that a coincidence, or you know, is it you know, like what you read about in Egyptology? They go into the tomb and.
Exactly. We were putting together a catalog resume of complete descriptions of every known copy, and I had one of my research assistants who was just sort of methodically going through and putting in owners and the owner's dates, and she looks up at me at one point and says, "Did you ever notice that many people die right after they buy this?" And it's just so fascinating. There's a guy who bought a first folio, and then
right.
a few months later was found dead in his chambers at the age of 43.
Right.
His brother inherited it and then was killed in a duel 20 days later.
Somebody bought a first folio and then boarded the ill-fated Titanic. I think my favorite one is somebody bought a first folio in April and in June was explaining how a windmill worked to his children, but he got too close and got decapitated by the windmill.
Well, you have a lot of strange stories in this book. There's a volume that was marked in red paint, or was it blood, on every page. What was the significance of that?
Yeah, this is really fascinating. There's a copy that's owned by a private family in Japan, and my project team was going around the world contacting private owners, asking if we could have access to their copies. And the response we got from this family was, well, we're very sorry, but our husband and father put in his will that no one can examine our first folio until 13 years after his death.
Right.
And this seemed just deeply suspicious to us. About the same time, a copy was stolen from a university in England. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we can't get to see this, we can't make a positive identification. But it seems deeply suspicious that you would put such a wanky provision in your will. I mean, why would you say that unless you're trying to protect your reputation or protect your family? Right. And this is the copy that we know is every page is stained with a red liquid, so this kind of adds to the mystery. It could be wine, it could be blood. But it may well be, apropos of your discussion about the Rembrandts and the private owners with the cognac, that there may be a Japanese millionaire with a stolen first folio that he just doesn't want the world to see.
Well, you know, there may be a question whether it's blood or paint, but what about the one with the bullet lodged in his pages?
That's fascinating.
I mean, this is kind of interesting. What about that? What did you determine about that one?
Well, this is a copy that was owned by William Congreve, who was a 18th century playwright. He's the one who coined the phrases "Hell hath no fury as a woman scorned" and "Music hath charms to soothe the savage beast." And we found that in his copy, there's a musket bullet going halfway through it. Now, this is a huge book. If it's just lying on a tabletop, it's not going to take a bullet. Somebody had to be holding this thing up, which is clearly, you know, an interesting rift on the Bible saved my life. My Shakespeare first folio saved my life.
I mean, and that's really interesting, knowing that these folios are, people must know they're valuable, you know, that they're worth a lot of money, even, you know, back a couple hundred years or so, right?
Absolutely.
On that sort of thing. Well, you traveled all over the world, right? How many countries did you visit?
I think 17.
17 countries, and I read where there's something like 230 first folios in existence?
Exactly. There are 232 that we've been able to locate.
Right.
We think about 750 were published originally, so that's a pretty good survival rate for a 400-year-old book, but this is also a huge book. It's not something that goes missing easily.
Right.
And so it's conceivable that there are still some out there. It's conceivable that some have been stolen. It's a really, my colleague Anthony James West, who started this all, was a fascinating guy. He was British, but he went to Harvard and did an MBA,
right,
and then brought American-British business know-how back to the UK when nobody was thinking that way, and he made a bundle. He became a partner with the management consultant firm Booz Allen, and he ran their South American office out of Rio de Janeiro, and then had a midlife crisis, gave it all up to do a PhD in English, and for his dissertation decided he would track down first folios. And he spent 15 years and his entire personal fortune doing this.
Wow.
I've never been able to decide if this was noble or foolish. But he found 70 copies that we didn't know existed before. And if you think this is a $7 million book,
right,
and there were 70 of them out there that we didn't know of before, it's really, really quite fascinating.
Yeah,
right.
And I've got a quick question here.
Go ahead.
What about deterioration of a book? You know, this book is 390 years old, these books. How does a aficionado protect that book from further deteriorating? I mean, paper doesn't last forever.
Well, but that's the interesting thing. In the Renaissance, they made paper out of linen rags. And so it is the greatest stuff. You can wash it. You can iron it. You can it, and you can make it look completely pristine, as opposed to paper made out of wood pulp, which is what 19th and 20th century books were, and the acids in the wood pulp eats away at the paper, which is why so many books from the 19th and early 20th century are now decaying in archives, and it is a big problem. But the stuff that they used in the Renaissance was just absolutely indestructible. Now, one of the weird things is you can take your books that are 400 years old, and you can literally wash them. And people do that. They're
wow.
It's cloth, and you can iron them, and you can make them look brand new.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, you traveled. You said 17 countries, and one of the interesting things is you ran into some heavily tattooed criminal gangs in Tokyo. What do heavily tattooed criminal gangs in Tokyo have to do with Willie Shakespeare?
Well, we think, and this is supposition. But we think that during the time when the yen was very high in the 70s and 80s, we know that the Japanese were purchasing every copy of the first folio that came on the market. Hmm. And so there's a university outside Tokyo that bought 12 copies of the first folio, and there's one in Kobe, and there's one in Kyoto, and there's this private copy that we were just speaking of. And we also know that in this period of history, they were buying Van Goghs. And they were buying, you know, and we also know that there was a black market for Western art in mm-hmm. Asia at this time. And so there is a copy that was stolen from the University of Manchester mm-hmm. and never been recovered. And the rumor is that it's in a Southeast Asian collection, and the Yakuza are deeply involved in the transport of black market art within Japan, and this is the Japanese mafia, right. And the Yakuza, of course, are heavily tattooed, and they cut off their fingers in order to show how tough they are.
Right.
And I had meetings. I actually had a meeting at the restaurant in Tokyo where they filmed Kill Bill to talk about how we might approach the Yakuza. In a rational way to see about enlisting their help in tracking down various folios. We didn't get very far.
Right. Yeah, Quentin Tarantino might have recruited you, eh?
Right.
for that film. Now, begs the question, have you faced any danger in your travels where, you know, you might have run into a situation where there was criminality involved and maybe your personal safety would have been, might have been compromised?
With the Japanese copy, there was a sense that the family understood that this might have been a stolen copy
right.
and would have liked nothing else but for me to make the identification and them to give it back to its rightful owners. Mm-hmm. After some initial contacts with the family, they completely clammed up. And we assume that somebody got to them and said, no, don't do this. We don't want, you know, if you implicate us in trafficking stolen merchandise,
right.
bad things will happen to you.
Right. So they've got some folios, right?
Yes.
And so and I know the goal of your project, I read this, where to make the folio the most, you know, documented book of all time, right? So you must be bugging you like hell, you know, the fact that you can't get at this. But what are you going to do?
Exactly. I mean, it's. I'm not sure. If this is a dead end, it's rather remarkably the only one we've run into. I mean, mm-hmm. we have dealt with dukes and earls and eccentric millionaires in the States, mm-hmm. and every one of them has given us more or less unfettered access to their copies. So I'm a little obsessive about the one that's in Japan, but if that's the only one that got away, I suppose I can live with it.
Yeah, that's gonna be the one that got away, right?
I think so. Yeah.
On that, then. Well, one of the interesting stories is one about that East Coast couple who drowned in a boating accident, and the next week a first folio appeared for sale in Kansas. And there's, you know, the question of murder, whether there was murder involved. Tell us about that. That's like a mystery.
It was so fascinating. They were at a peaceful lakeside resort in Maine, and this is in the late 19th century, and had gone out to take a picnic with a couple of canoes and with some friends, and as they're returning from their picnic, with the other canoes and within sight of the lodge, this society couple apparently both fell out of the canoe and drowned. And there's no there's no hint of anyone else helping them, or it's funny, the New York Times reports that the inquest decided it was their fault for not sitting still in their canoe. And then, exactly, they'd owned the First Folio, which a week later was mysteriously appeared in Kansas, in Kansas, and then, or it could have been Kentucky. And
I think it was then, Kansas.
In Kansas, and then wound up in the hands of the Astor family, the
famous Astor family
of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel,
right.
And then migrated to Japan. So it's one of the ones that's in Japan now. So this has a very dubious provenance as it's worked through.
Right. So what do you do about that? About that particular folio? What are you going to do about that?
We know where it is now. I mean, we this is one of the ones that's in an archive in Japan, and the Japanese legitimately bought it from the Astors, but it's its history which is so fascinating.
Right. Well, have you looked at it?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay, that's great then. Well, you know, there have been some happy endings in the 1940s, that theft at Williams College, the First Folio, but it was ultimately returned. That's an interesting story. Tell us about that.
Well, and again, back to the early discussion about the Rembrandts, the Shakespeare thieves are not Moriartys. They're often, you know, very, very minor criminals who, this was a criminal gang who decided they would impersonate a college professor who wanted to do some research, and so they took one of the members of their gang and they powdered his hair because they figured that's what the way college professors look.
Right.
And he went in and asked for it at the library and was given access to it and escaped with it in a briefcase and then made his escape by public bus, which you have to love. Your million-dollar book. And then, this was at the end of the Depression, as you say, in the 1940s,
right.
And the thief became concerned that one of his conspirators was going to sell the book to Hitler. And in a fit of nationalism and in a drunken stupor, went and turned himself in because he didn't want to see the book going to Hitler.
Well, now, where are you with the project now? What's your immediate goals with the project?
Well, we have just published the complete catalog listing of all the known First Folios, all the ones that we have found and had access to, and as you mentioned, with complete descriptions of everything, so every watermark, every press variant, every damage or repair, and what's fascinating about this is there are First Folios that have wine stains on them. There are ones that have burn marks, burn holes where people used to smoke cigars while they, and we found paw prints where cats walk across First Folios. And the point of all this is that if a copy is stolen, recently a copy was stolen from Durham University, and the thief thought all he had to do to disguise it was to sort of tear off the cover and tear off the front page that might have had the library stamp on it. this is fascinating. A British subject walked into the Folger Shakespeare Library with this, what appeared to be a First Folio, asking to have it authenticated, and the librarians quickly recognized that it was a copy that had been stolen from Durham University in the northeast of England, and then the guy in question said that he got it from one of Fidel Castro's bodyguards in Cuba. But then it turned out,
do you believe that?
Then it turned out that the guy in question lived 3 miles away from Durham Cathedral, and he's now doing 8 years behind bars for transporting stolen property and taking stolen property out of the UK. But it used to be thought that you could just sort of tear off a page or two and then claim you discovered it in your grandmother's attic.
Right.
But now, with our catalog, everything, every page of every every first folio is more or less fingerprinted.
Right. Well, we've got about 1 minute. We could go on for another hour because it's such a fascinating topic. So I have a couple of questions and we'll need short answers for them. One of them is, you got any tips for people who may own valuable books, documents, and not necessarily Shakespeare folio, but books? To protect them from thieves.
Well, yeah, don't let anyone know. We gave all our private owners sort of the option of maintaining their privacy. We would either print their name or their address, or, you know, we had one owner who said, well, you can say it's in Europe. That's all you can do.
That's funny. Now, if anybody knows of a folio or even might even have one and was willing to talk to you, what did they do? You talked about this project. Who would they contact?
They can contact me directly, and we often do. I just heard from someone in India who thinks that they may have a first folio, and my team may have to go out on a trek. I'm not sure Sherpas
will. Well, we got listeners. We have listeners all over the world, and you're at the University of Nevada.
University of Nevada, Reno.
And do you have a website?
I don't, but the university does, and I'm happy to receive emails through that.
Right. It's very easy to find you. You've been a really fascinating guest. We appreciate your time on the show. Wish we had more time. As usual, we always have fascinating guests, and this has been a really interesting, illuminating topic. So thanks for being on the show, Dr. Rasmussen.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Right. Well, we're talking with Dr. Eric Rasmussen, University of Nevada at Reno. He's author of Shakespeare Thefts in Search of the First Folio, another Paul Grade Macmillan book, and it's a great read, and we recommend it. Willie?
Well, great. That was a fascinating, great interview. Thanks again for that, Ronnie, and thanks again to our very special guests, Eric Rasmussen, Anthony Amore, and Tom Mashberg. We're privileged to have them on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about the interview tonight?
Well, I learned that I got to go to more art museums. I haven't had a chance because I've been so busy, but it's just a fascinating subject. I love having guests on that talk about art. You know, we had Robert Whitman at one time when we first began this show, and these two guests were great. And hopefully we could have a couple more shows.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, here's your chance to buy some art. Since the economy is tanking, we're all going to go into the poorhouse. Here's your chance to buy some.
Yeah, I got to take a couple of $1 million out of my out of my portfolio.
Right
on that.
Well, anyway, what I learned is that stolen art, I'll tell you, man, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and there's really a lot of unscrupulous people out there that will go to very extraordinary measures to steal art. You know what? Very, very expensive books. A first folio could be up $7-10 million. You know, Ronnie, I think we missed our calling.
Well, what do you mean?
We should have been thieves.
Painters or painters or thieves?
judging by our background in the East End, we could have been great ones.
Well, yeah, you're always a con man, so and I was always the creative one, so yeah. We know what we're respectfully going to go into, right?
Right on. Hey, well, great guest tonight. Yeah. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our gangster nickname of the month segment. Take Joseph Massino, a.k.a. Big Joey, or The Ear. He used to be the boss of the Bonanno family, whose activities under Joseph Joe Bananas Bonanno were chronicled by Gay Talese in Honor Thy Father. Massino got the name The Ear because he was so conscious of surveillance under the RICO anti-racketeering laws that he told associates to touch their ears when referring to him, rather than speaking his name. Hey, this guy was a real mime, Ronnie. Any comments?
Yeah, you remember back in the East End when you had your back turned, we used to touch our ears. If it was not because of, we thought people were listening in, it was because, you know what. But this character, Joe Bonanno, actually died in his bed in 2002 at age 97. And we had the Colombo Wars on last week. There was a banana war. war in the 1960s, which forced Joe Bonanno into retirement. And he went to Arizona, where he lived out in these days. Yeah. Interesting character.
Well, may he rest in peace, man. May he rest
right.
in peace. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for December the 15th, where we'll have as our very special guest Mr. Lou Ferrante, former gangster who penned the best-selling book titled Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artists First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artists First World Radio Network. We'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. And in the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. And please spread the word about our program. If you want to support Crime Beat, please make a contribution to Crime Beat via the Artists First World Radio Network. The address is on the top page of the website for your quick reference. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Shepsick and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time, at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.